Hello, I'm Robert M. Ellis, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority.
Our guest today is Sangharakshita, who is the founder of the Triratna Buddhist Order and Triratna Buddhist Community, which was previously known as the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, or FWBO. He's also the author of dozens of books and hundreds of lectures on Buddhism. Brought up in London, Sangharakshita spent 20 years in India, where he was ordained as a Buddhist monk, but then returned to the UK in the 1960s to become one of the first figures to engage seriously with the need to interpret Buddhist practice for Western audiences. He has done so particularly through the use of practical concepts like integration, individuality, creativity, and provisional belief. So, welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast, Sangharakshita. Thank you for agreeing to this discussion. So, would you like to start off by saying a little bit about yourself for the benefit of people who don't know you?
I'm now 92, so I do have quite a number of years to look back on. And I might say that those years and the experiences of those years have perhaps embraced extremes. As you've already heard, I spent time in India. And I spent time in India as a Buddhist monk, living what perhaps most best describe as a very simple, even very ascetic life. Now, of course, I'm not a bhikkhu, I'm not a monk, and I'm not leading such a simple life as before. I won't say that I'm going to the other extreme, but one can get the idea that in the course of my life I've tended first a little to that side and then a little to the other side. So we come, as it were, to the principle of the middle way. And of course, as a monk all those years ago, I thought very much in terms of the middle way as the Buddha himself approached it. Originally, the Buddha had been practicing severe asceticism with a group of friends or followers. But eventually he decided that that was not the way, and he left those friends and went off on his own. And those friends thought, or assumed, he was returning to a life of luxury. So when, after his enlightenment, he again contacted them, that was what they still taught, and they reproached him for sliding away from the path of strict asceticism to what they regarded as luxury, in other words, actually eating once a day. So that does suggest, from this early episode, that what the Buddha spoke of as the life of self-indulgence on the one hand and the life of spiritual practice on the other were not, one might say, opposites in the strict sense. The one did not totally exclude the other. Because in the first place, even after returning to or discovering the middle way, the Buddha was leading a life that we might consider very, not simple, but very ascetic. But from his point of view, he was following the middle way. And that might not be what we regard as the middle way. If we were to live as he then lived, we wouldn't be regarding it as simple, we would be regarding it as very strict. But others in the Buddha's time, especially the Jains, they thought differently. Well, to begin with, his own disciples, or those who became his disciples, thought differently. They thought that our friend Gotama has been backsliding. He's gone back to an easy way of life. But the Buddha says, no, not. I'm following a middle way. But from the Jain's perspective, Buddhists of their day used to give themselves an easy time. So what the Buddhists regarded as following a middle way, the Jains regarded as following a rather extreme way, totally opposed not just to asceticism, but almost to any form of discipline. So the question of opposites, or opposite points of view, is not quite so clear. It's more a question of different degrees of the same thing, because both Jain monks and Buddhist monks ate food, both depended on alms food, but one might say that the Jain monks took very, very much less than the Buddhist monks. So it wasn't so much a question of following opposite paths, but following the same path, but to a different degree. And I just mentioned the question of food, but there are other differences. The Buddhist monks shaved their heads, but the Jain monks pulled out each hair separately, which was a painful process. So the aim of both was the same in a way. Both wanted to remove the hair of the head, but one did it in the easy way, and the other did it in a more difficult, painful way. But nonetheless, we have this idea of a middle way, of not going to extremes, of being moderate.
It's not just a conventional moderation, is it? As you've been saying, it's not just what people in society might generally think is moderate.
Yes.
So what would you say that the moderation is based on in the middle way, as you understand it?
Well, I look more to what the Buddha said in relation to the playing of the Vinaya. Well, the string should not be too taut, not too tight. It should not be too slack. So in the spiritual life, yes, one needs to make an effort on all fronts, a very definite, consistent, maintained effort. But it should not go to extremes. You should not force yourself. You should not do what you're not really physically and mentally capable of doing. At the same time, you should not be too relaxed, too easygoing about your practice of the spiritual life. So I think this is a very relevant sort of attitude. It's very relevant to any sincere practice of the spiritual life. Not give yourself too hard a time unnecessarily, but neither give oneself too easy a time. Here one finds an exemplification of the middle way.
So it's closely related to right effort.
Yes.
I mean, do you think do the four exertions help us to understand the middle way as an aspect of right effort?
Help one to understand the middle way? Yes, I think if one is mindful and watches oneself and tries to see when you're trying too hard and when you're trying too little or too little hard, well, you can see, as it were, in between, there's another way, there's the middle way. Neither too hard nor too relaxed. So you can discover that through one's own efforts and one's own experiments over the course of one's spiritual life.
Well, asceticism and hedonism,
yes,
are very much about how we regard pain and pleasure.
Yes.
Yeah, the middle way there. But isn't there also a middle way that relates, or an aspect related to that, of the middle way, that relates to our beliefs about the world, the ideologies we adhere to and so on.
Yes, I mean, if you're inclined to take things easily, you're likely to have a rather, you know, easygoing conception of the world and of society and its demands upon you. On the other hand, you may have a quite different view of the world, that the world is a hard place and one makes one's way in that world only by quite a lot of effort. So there is a connection in that sort of way between your personal practice and your view of the world and of what society demands or what society regards more highly.
So, would you say you're influenced by Nagarjuna's account of the middle way, internalism and nihilism and views of existence and so on?
Yes, that is very important, I mean, especially with regard to the question of rebirth or reincarnation. Because from the Buddhist point of view, and as I personally see it, there is not one unchanging personal entity that moves now from this life, now from that, so that the continuity is provided by the fact that there's an unchanging entity which moves from this life to that life. I mean, the Buddhist conception is more that of a river flowing, and as you cannot see that the later stages are different or not different from the earlier stages, regardless, of course, of whether the flow of consciousness is connected with this life or with that life.
What would you say to the idea that rebirth itself is, the belief in rebirth is eternalist or depends on some absolute positive beliefs about the spiritual life?
No, certainly not a question of determinism. I mean, the Buddha has certainly made that clear. Some time ago, I did say that what we had was a stream of experience, and we can superimpose upon that the idea of freedom or the idea of determination. But those are only our own views or conceptions superimposed upon the actual experience of the continuity of consciousness.
So, is there an essential mystery you feel we need to accept about rebirth that involves staying?
No, I don't think that. I think the idea or the notion of rebirth has nothing really mysterious about it. From my point of view, it seems quite natural, as it were. This may be because I've recently been looking at a book by, what's his name, he's a German monk, a bhikkhu, and he's writing about rebirth and consciousness and pratitya samuppada. And I think the Buddhist view is quite consistent, and I don't think that we have any reason not to assume that consciousness can continue connecting now with this body and now with that. I don't see that there's anything self-contradictory in this idea, and it certainly doesn't presuppose a transmigrating entity which does not change.
But I mean, nevertheless, would you say that people could practice the middle way without accepting beliefs like rebirth or without accepting Buddhism, indeed?
Yes, because what does the middle way consist of? So, right livelihood, one simple thing, or right effort. So one doesn't have to be a Buddhist in order to accept and practice those things.
So you see a connection between the middle way and the other elements of the Eightfold Path, apart from right effort?
Yes. It's because if the middle way as a whole is a middle way, I suppose it follows that each item, each stage of the middle way in itself represents a medial position between two particular extremes.
So, how would you understand those extremes in the most general way? I mean, obviously, Buddhist tradition tends to talk about eternalism and nihilism or annihilationism, doesn't it? How do you understand those extremes?
Well, we've got to start off with Samyak Drishti, which means white vision, which means, well, a number of things. It's applied in a number of situations. For instance, with the regard to so-called reincarnation, to believe that at death there is an absolute cessation, that the body dies but there's no survival with regard to the mind or the consciousness. That's one extreme. The other extreme, of course, is that there is something that survives, but it is something that survives unchanging from the previous life. That's the eternalistic extreme. So here, with regard to right vision or Samyak Drishti, one has a particular form of the middle way as between eternalism and nihilism with regard to survival or non-survival after physical death.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much the middle way in relation to the ideologies that were important in the Buddha's time, isn't it? The discussion about karma and rebirth.
Yes, because there were some teachers or believers at the time of the Buddha who did not believe in any form of survival after death as regards the human being. And of course later they were known as the Charvakas, and they're still there, quite late in the history of religion in India. Of course they disagreed with most other practitioners and philosophers, most of whom accepted rebirth in one form or another, the Buddhist form or a non-Buddhist form.
But what do you think that should mean today? So if somebody's, for example, struggling with their attitude towards their workplace and the policies of the company they work for or something of that kind, is the Buddha's middle way relevant to them today?
Well, that raises really the question of right means of livelihood. So what would be a good means of livelihood with regard to the middle way? Well, I would say there's a means of livelihood which provides the person concerned with an income, but not at the expense of other human beings. But that's not so easy really to follow up. But the immediate work that you do may not be harmful, but the whole process may involve harm to other living beings. I mean, for instance, you may be a tailor. Your work does no harm to anyone. It's useful to society. But the cloth you're working, where did it come from? Under what conditions was it produced? Did producing that cloth entail serious harm to other human beings? So it's not such a simple issue, even if the principle is clear.
So would you say that the middle way requires us to engage with that complexity rather than making big assumptions?
Yes, well, one has assumptions, but one has to see how they work out in actual practice. If you take a wider range of society and a longer process into consideration.
So there might be, say, if there was a company that intended to sack a lot of workers in order to make economies because of a view about what would be economically effective. Now, can the middle way be applied in those sorts of decisions?
Well, it depends who's in charge. It may be a board of directors, and maybe a lot would depend upon how important each of those directors considered the moral issue.
So it depends on the individual thinking in terms of the middle way?
Yes, because in regard to the decision of that board, the view of each individual director would contribute to their eventual decision. Maybe those who would be more observant of a middle way and so on would be outvoted or not.
So, I mean, do you think the middle way could be used more corporately? You know, you could use it as a basis of discussion for a policy rather than just an individual approach?
Yes, I think it could. In the case of business organisations and members of boards, yes, ideology can always be a factor, but it's the ideology of the middle way or another. And what another ideology might be that profit has to be regarded as the most important thing.
It could be the absolutization of profit on the one hand, or maybe at the other extreme, the freedom of the workers, or some other criterion, that you're avoiding both those extremes.
Yes. Well, no doubt the well-being of the worker has to be a consideration. Mm. Otherwise, a worker who's always going sick, that's not very profitable in the long run. So yes, even in one's own interest, one has to consider the well-being of the worker. It doesn't necessarily mean that one believes in the middle way and for that reason considers the well-being of the worker.
It could be either way round.
Yes.
Yeah. So the middle way could emerge into people's awareness from other kinds of concerns that they might develop.
Yes. Yes, because the two extremes are an organisation which is run for profit predominantly, on the other hand, an organisation that is run not for profit, but as a public service.
I mean, if we take another kind of application, how would you say the middle way could be applied in meditation, the context of meditation?
Well, I think here the Buddhist simile of the lute applies. As in meditation, as in other aspects of the spiritual life, one can go to extremes. You sometimes, where it's a mistake in some cases, if you think that the more meditation you do, in the sense of the practice, the more quickly the results will come, but that's not necessarily the case. For instance, someone might argue, well, if I meditate for an hour, well, I get a very blissful experience, but if I was to meditate for 2 hours, it would be twice as blissful. But no, it doesn't necessarily follow this. More a materialistic sort of attitude to meditation.
Why would you say materialistic? What's materialistic about it?
Because one was thinking in terms of quantity.
So measurable outcomes.
Something measurable.
Right, right. So it's more about you're talking more about an obsessive approach to things being measurable or quantifiable.
Yes. So most people, learn by experience what they can do and how long they can sustain a particular kind of effort.
I mean, do you think it applies more at the the level of each moment as well in meditation. So there's always a balancing point, isn't there, in one's experience, that you can be distracted in one sort of way and then in another.
Yes. Well, that's why it's important in most forms of meditation to have a bit something on which at least to begin with you concentrate and to ward off any distraction. And that should bring one over a period of time to a point where one can be, as it were, concentrated without anything that you're concentrating on, and where you don't need to ward off distractions. Mm. In other words, where you're concentrated, but you're not concentrating on anything in particular.
So is that moving more towards what you've described as a just sitting kind of practice?
Put it this way, whether not necessarily to begin with, because with the just sitting practice you don't usually start off with something on which you concentrate. And gradually allow the object of concentration to fade away, as it were. Usually with the just sitting practice, it's the sitting posture itself that one can be said to concentrating on, in a sense that it's just the sitting posture that is present to your consciousness, as it were, a gross object of consciousness instead of a subtle one.
I mean, that raises an interesting point, I think, which is the relationship between the body and the middle way. I mean, would you say that the middle way in some way, or our capacity to practice the middle way, emerges from our bodily awareness in some sense?
Well, one way of practicing is by scanning the body. By scanning the body, you know, from the feet upwards, going quite slowly, that can be a starting point, because it will certainly reduce the activity of the mind when you're just scanning, just looking. You're not thinking about the body or reflecting on it as you will be doing in other practices. But in this practice, you don't reflect, you just observe, you see.
Similarly, I guess, if one's not going to be diverted by strong emotions like anger, for example, then a basis in the body can anchor us, can't it, to help to prevent that?
Well, awareness can have a modifying or calming effects on any strong or violent emotion. Yes.
So wouldn't that potentially have an impact on our decisions in all areas of life, that we might make hasty decisions under the impact of violent emotion?
Yes, and if we were more aware of our emotion, including the violent emotion, we'd be less likely to act upon it.
Yeah, we've got a context to put it in.
Yes.
How important do you think the middle way is in Buddhism as it's generally practiced? Do you think that Buddhists give enough attention to it?
They probably don't. Maybe not enough serious attention. But of course, it's generally known that Buddhism believes in a middle way. No self-indulgence, no self-torture. I mean, that's pretty generally understood. But it doesn't really mean very much if you take it only so far. I don't think many Buddhists engage very seriously with the question of the middle way and its different forms and applications. Maybe people who meditate will be aware that, well, they mustn't make too much of an effort and at the same time not enough. I think they'd be aware of that. But I think broadly speaking, I doubt whether Buddhists in general reflect much upon the middle way.
So why do you think that is?
Well, different traditions have developed other things that people are interested in or which they practice.
So are you thinking of specific traditions like the Pure Land emphasising the the matter.
Yes, I wasn't thinking of that, but yes, that is an example. Mm. Yes. But there, of course, there has to be something on which you concentrate. I mean, some of those practitioners will concentrate on the repetition of a mantra, and others will try to visualize the pure lands and imagine themselves as it were being reborn there or entering there.
Mm. But doesn't it depend how you go about a practice like that, whether you're doing it in a middle way, oriented way or not?
I think with regard to that practice, as far as I can remember, I don't think they started off from a consideration of where it stood in relation to the middle way. Yes.
Well, because they were more concerned with other power and concepts like that?
Yes. Well, of course, they can be, preoccupied with that higher power in another way. One could, of course, look at it from the standpoint of middle way and say that, some might think, well, self-power is one extreme, other power is the other extreme, so is there a middle way? And that could be a conundrum, a koan. So if the Pure Land practice is a middle way, well, what is it a middle way between? Hmm? I don't know whether that question is considered.
Mm.
Because the middle way ultimately is a matter of practice, or it has to find issue in practice and one's actual attitude.
Mm.
Just as in the case of the middle way between self-indulgence and self-torture.
So it seems that quite a few Buddhists, perhaps in certain traditions, tend to pay lip service to the middle way rather than reflecting on it.
Yes, I mean, just from my sort of general reading and all that over the years, I think that's what I would say.
And what about the other side of it? I mean, you agreed earlier that it might be possible to practice the middle way outside Buddhism. Do you think it's developed outside Buddhism in other respects?
Confucianism is a bit like that. So it's not usually regarded as a religion, but in the West it would have to be somehow connected with philosophy or with religion. Maybe among the ancient Greeks, one of the wise men said, nothing in excess. That's the sort of middle way.
Hmm.
Not too much, not too little.
Have you come across Pyrrhonism?
Yes. Well, some believe that there is some historical connection between Pyrrhonism and early Buddhism.
Mm.
Mm.
But there's definitely a middle way emphasis there, I think, which resembles Nagarjuna's avoidance of positive and negative claims.
So I see Nagarjuna more within my sort of a metaphysical context.
What does that mean to you, a metaphysical context?
Well, it means ultimately not viewing whatever is ultimate either in positive or negative terms. In other words, it means seeing both positive and negative terms as not applicable to what we nonetheless term ultimate reality. So you're left in the end with Vimalakirti's noble silence.
So that's what might be described by some philosophers as a critical metaphysics. It's got a position which is able to criticise different metaphysical claims.
Well, because Nagarjuna is critical in a way like Kant is critical. When you have it's two theses, each of which cancels the other out. So yes, you're left in the end with your silence you, noble or otherwise. Yeah.
What about in science and our attitudes to science? Do you think there's an application of the middle way there?
Well, what is science? Well, through science we're trying to associate the truth of things, whether in the field of the outer world or the inner world. It just says Einstein's theory or doctrine of relativity is an attempt to show how things actually are at one end of the scale, and then at the other end, of course, you have nuclear physics, which tries to understand what things are like at the very opposite end, the infinitesimal. And they both are science, and you know, within those spheres are all sorts of, you know, subdivisions. I think Herbert Spencer once said that first of all there's ordinary understanding, and then there's, which is uncoordinated understanding on knowledge, and then there's science, which is partially coordinated into the different sciences. And then he says there's philosophy, which provides the ultimate coordination. I don't know whether scientists nowadays would agree with that.
But isn't there's a danger of dogma in science, isn't there, as in other places? So you could get carried away with some particular theory?
Yes, but scientists would assume that there's nothing really to do with science as such. It's just a failure on the part of the individual. And eventually, of course, that will be realised, whether by the scientist himself or other scientists.
You talked earlier about materialism. Do you think materialism is a trap for science?
Well, I know materialism is the old term, but I'd rather really use a more recent term, which is physicalism. There is only, you know, physical experience. I don't know Rosner has written about that. So in a sense, going back, I'm a bit of an immaterialist of the Berkeleyan kind. I see it as in a way an aspect of Buddhism, that behind phenomena there are not entities which are somehow standing behind phenomena.
So do you see that as compatible with the middle way, or is that a tendency to drift away from it?
Yes. I see that as compatible with the middle way, the vision of the middle way, let us say.
So the middle way isn't in between realism and idealism, for instance?
It's between realism in the popular sense and idealism. I could see the middle way as being between those two, yes.
Well, I meant more in the philosophical sense of both of those terms. Realism, that there's real stuff, and idealism, that there isn't.
Well, in one sense, realism is idealism, or idealism is realism, whether used in a popular sense or a Platonic sense. I think it's, if one wants to use the middle way as a general philosophical concept, I'm not sure what particular pairs of opposites that stands between, because the middle way opposite implies that it is situated between a pair of opposites, as with the self-indulgence and self-torture. But if the middle way is to be a general philosophical principle, which are the two extremes it stands between?
So you don't think we could be agnostic about issues like realism and idealism rather than adopting one or the other?
But are those two opposites, or are they just different?
Well, each denies the other completely, doesn't it?
So they're mutually exclusive. So the extent that they're mutually exclusive, the middle way would be a middle way between them. But only if they were mutually exclusive, not if they were just different.
Sure, I mean, there isn't a middle way between cats and dogs, you know, they're just different.
But coming back to this question, Middle Way is the other religions. When you've written on the Middle Way in Christianity, I think.
That's right, yes.
So where do you locate the Middle Way, say, in Christianity or Christian tradition or the teaching of Jesus?
Well, I think it's a matter of responsible interpretation, in that you can find elements of it in the teachings of Jesus. You can also find it, I think, in the symbolism of Christ, so the way in which he's both divine and human, and can't be entirely categorised as either of those opposites.
Which isn't something midway between the two, because according to standard Christian teaching, he's equally both.
Yeah. But I'm more interested there in the way it functions, so whether Christians sometimes have an insight into the way in which it can be neither, we can neither be completely perfect like God, nor should we simply accept imperfection. So there's a tension there and an ambiguity that seems to me to express.
Well, there was a lot of tension in the early days of Christianity as to whether in what sense Jesus was both God and man. There's quite a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah. Sure. Well, if you turn it into an absolute theological position, then it causes opposites and conflict.
Yes. Some said that Christ was just a very exceptionally good man. Others said that no, he was God in the full sense of the term. So is there a middle way between that?
Well, I think it's an agnostic approach, that we don't accept either of those absolute claims.
Yes.
But we consult our experience and think, well, what does this actually mean in our experience? And in what ways is it valuable in our experience? Mm.
Yes. So you think that there is a middle way somewhere in Christianity or Christian tradition?
Yeah, I mean, it requires a critical process to separate it out from the absolutizations,
but it
can be found. And the same seems to apply to Buddhism to a lesser extent, to me, that you need a critical process to separate the middle way from other things, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes, of course, because the Buddha has said so many other things. What he said about the middle way, especially in its original sense, is one of the things he said. Of course, one can regard some things he said as more important or significant than others.
Yeah. I mean, you've been through that process, haven't you, because you had to decide how to present Buddhism in the Western context. I mean, do you think the middle way played a part in your judgment about what aspects of Buddhism to emphasise?
I don't think it did. Perhaps I should have done, but I don't think it did. I think the middle way as a teaching of the Buddha, say, was more important for me when I was a monk.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, of course, was practising, as it were, the softer approach rather than the harsher approach. Mm.
Or is that's where you write about Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2?
Yes, one could put it that way. That is connected. Mm. In the case of the Western Buddhist order originally, I was trying to define what was a Buddhist. And I didn't decide what a Buddhist follows the middle way. The Buddhist is one who goes for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. If I had said a Buddhist is one who follows the middle way, that might have been understood as not following, other teachings of the Buddha. But yes, be that as it may, I don't think the consideration of the middle way came into my thinking at that point, you know. Though of course I had written and spoken about the middle way as a part of the Buddha's teaching. That was there, I mean, in the survey and in the three jewels, before there was any Western Buddhist order. But also somewhere there was the definition of a Buddhist as one who goes for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And of course the teaching of the middle way would be included in the Dharma, because it wasn't explicitly mentioned, it wouldn't mean that it wasn't there. So I wouldn't say that accepting the teaching of the middle way by itself would make one a Buddhist, because I mean it is only part of the Buddha's teaching and could exist in other contexts. So for me it's the going for refuge that makes one a Buddhist. So three refuges, not the fourth.
So what's the fourth?
Well, the fourth in Tibetan Buddhism is the guru, especially the Vajrayana guru. Yudhisthira has this whole issue of the Vajra guru has arisen very recently in connection with Sergiel and his disciples.
In connection with who?
Sergiel Rinpoche.
Oh, right, yes, yes.
He's alleged to have mistreated them, but he seems to have believed that he was just acting like a Vajra guru.
So, do you think that that kind of emphasis on the guru goes away from the middle way in some respects in Tibetan tradition, giving such absolute authority to the guru?
I think it does, because it's so very extreme. But of course, on the other hand, I'm not prepared to say that it doesn't work in some cases. Some cases it does, but I think for myself there's no false refuge, because in the Tibetan system, if you take the false refuge in the teacher, there's a samaya that binds you, which you break only at the cost of going to the Vajra hell, which you stay in for millions of years. I don't think that's quite Buddhism.
Certainly not the middle way.
It's not the middle way, no.
No. Okay, well, perhaps we'd better wind it up there, but thank you very much for all that, Sankarvachita.
Yes.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.